Hello and welcome to the second episode of Gascast, the monthly podcast for trainee anaesthetists. In this episode, we'll be seeing what we collectively learnt from the college's fourth national audit project, reviewing the use of food supplements as a treatment for preeclampsia, and I'll be talking to Ala Belhaj, who's recently been in Tunisia helping with the Libyan refugee relief effort. I'm Rick Thomas, and back with me for round two are Frank Schneider.
Hello.
Rebecca Smith.
Hey, Rick.
And Mark Salmon.
Hello.
So, to get cracking with our Discovery of the Month section, Bex, what has amazed you this month?
Well, my mum sent me a newspaper clipping which claimed that eating chocolate will halve the risk of a premature delivery, and was published by the Daily Mail, which, when I looked it up online...
Your mum sends you clippings from the Daily Mail.
Well, published in South Africa, but originally reported in the Daily Mail, and it was reported in last July. And when I researched a bit further, it's not actually an entirely accurate claim.
No.
Surprise, surprise. But it comes from a study which was published in the Annals of Epidemiology in May 2008. It was a prospective study from the States which looked at 2,500 women and asked them to self-report chocolate consumption during pregnancy. And the background to this was the thought that the risk factor for preeclampsia are similar to those for cardiovascular disease. And dark chocolate is supposed to be good for your cardiovascular system. And they were wondering whether eating chocolate would then be preventative against this. And actually, of the pre-eclamptics, there was a significant proportion, so 38%, that didn't eat chocolate regularly, compared to 19% of people with normal blood pressure that didn't eat chocolate regularly. So what they were thinking is that if you tend to eat chocolate regularly, you're less likely to develop preeclampsia. But there is a little note at the bottom of the article just saying that this isn't proven, it's just an indication for further trials, and they would still only recommend that people use chocolate as a small treat and not eat it too regularly.
Oh, that's very interesting. That does sound like sort of a chocolate lover has managed to make a sort of self-reported retrospective epidemiology study, which proves their point.
Absolutely.
Which I think is quite easy to do. But
Bex, I was just wondering, does that mean your mum knows you like chocolate or is hoping you're pregnant?
I think it's a bit of both. Desperate for grandkids.
Right.
So Frank, you actually gave me a little bit of a spoiler for your Discovery of the Month, but I think it's a fascinating little bit of anaesthetic history.
Well, I thought the Mayfair Gas Company was quite interesting. Those of you who aren't familiar with it will be intrigued to realise that it was founded by none other than Sir Robert McIntosh in 1933. And this, of course, was in the time before the NHS. And one of the ways of providing anaesthetic services was to form what was essentially a private consortium, from what I gather, the bit of reading I can find online. In any case, Sir McIntosh and two colleagues of his, William McConnell and Bernard Johnson, formed the Mayfair Gas Company, which was an anaesthetic group, and they set up shop in McIntosh's home in Mayfair. And it soon acquired the nickname of the Gas Fight and Choke Company, and that was mostly in reference to the company that supplied sort of gas for heating, cooking and lighting in the area, which was called the Gas, Light and Coke Company. The other thing that was interesting about this was that at the time, one of the requirements for being a member was that you had to have your own car, because obviously you had to be able to carry around the not inconsiderable bulky kit that would be required to deliver anaesthesia.
I absolutely love this story. I think it's... I love the whole image of these anaesthetists, which is a new specialty. A fairly new specialty then, just deciding that we'll set up shop in my home in Mayfair, you can just do that, and then we'll just run around delivering anaesthetics in London out the back of our car, going up to places. I like that kind of entrepreneurial spirit with the innovation of sort of a new branch of medicine. I think it's really great. So this month I've discovered QR codes, which are those funny little black and white patches. One of which was on the cover of this month's BJA. But I've seen those around a lot on various things. I kind of know you can take a picture with your mobile phone, but I've not actually gone ahead and done it, to the extent that I didn't realise my phone had a built-in app to do it. So I was very excited. Clicked the thing to see what happened. And it takes a photo, and basically this code has a little bit of information, which is normally, I think, quite often the link to a website, and it was in this case, and then links you through to the Oxford Journal's website so you can look at the copy of the BJA on your portable device, which I was initially very impressed with. And then when I sort of suffered, when I had to log in and was slightly slow connection speed, and I haven't got an iPhone, so I don't have a decent screen. I was kind of wondering what was the point because I had the BJA in my hand. Just didn't quite understand why you would want it. Impressed that it worked, but I'm not really sure what the point of going through and reading it on my mobile phone, which I think probably is still slightly inferior to having the paper copy, if you've already got the paper copy, which you must have to see the QR code. So I don't know. I don't know if I'm being stupid and there is actually a better point to that. Mark, you know something about this, don't you?
I would guess that it's future proofing. It might be useful for collecting references when you aren't a subscriber to the journal. If you have a pile of journals, you can scan them all in and use some kind of reference manager to.
Clearly, I think it's a message to you, Rick, that you need an iPad 2, because using the camera that's built in, you could scan the code in and then you could go to the website and then upload whichever articles were of interest to something like Dropbox or Stanza and have them permanently stored on your iPad for when you're doing those long, boring plastics lists.
Oh, I see. Okay, no, that's very clever. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, especially if you've got an iPad, which I don't. So it's probably a case of me being too technologically behind the times to understand what it's for. Okay, well, very good. Mark, what have you got for us this month?
My discovery this month got me very excited. Because it basically keeps me away from labour ward as much as possible. I read a headline that said, "Vitamins and diet supplements cut the risk of preeclampsia in pregnant women." And I thought that was brilliant. Sadly, I then looked at the top of the page and realised that headline was, like Bex's, it was in the Daily Mail. So I had to do a bit more investigation, but be encouraged, they are actually quoting data from a proper science study published in the British Medical Journal. So I thought I'd better have a look at that. They describe a randomized controlled trial looking at the effect of supplementation during pregnancy with L-arginine and antioxidant vitamins on preeclampsia in a high-risk population. And what they claim to find in this study is that the ladies who had a combination of the L-arginine and the antioxidant vitamins did have a significantly lower rate of preeclampsia during their pregnancy. It's still not quite as exciting as I'd originally thought, because when you look more closely into the paper, there are a few caveats pointed out in an editorial in the BMJ in the same edition, and they are, first of all, the study was performed on a population which had a very high baseline rate of preeclampsia. Almost all of the subjects in the study had previously had pregnancies complicated by preeclampsia. Second of all, the preeclampsia definition was an arbitrary level of blood pressure, which doesn't really reflect the clinical spectrum, and so just a small move in blood pressure in the trial group moved a handful of the candidates across this threshold and may well have skewed the results in favor of the treatments.
Yeah, I mean, I thought I read this article as well, and I thought it was very interesting. I think there's a it highlights the difference between Bex's self-reported retrospective study and this, which was a properly randomized controlled trial. But as you mentioned, or there was all this comes up in the editorial about the slightly strange way of doing the statistics, and a few of the other problems. The editorial's excellent. We'll definitely put the link to that on the podcast notes so people can have a look. I didn't quite understand why they had to use bars with L-arginine in, because they said they couldn't get hold of it. But I've had a quick Google, and there's thousands of people who will sell you L-arginine tablets on the internet.
From
But
reputable sources or just from anywhere?
it's from the internet. That's a very reputable source. You can trust anything from the internet,
Yeah, of course.
including this podcast. Our next section is the news. And first up, Bex, you're going to talk to us about the very impressive fourth national audit project that the Royal College has just completed and published.
Absolutely. So this is a joint project that the college did with the Difficult Airway Society, and it looked at the major complications of airway management in the UK. It was, as you say, absolutely brilliant and set up in a similar method to the way that the NAP3 was. So they to look at the incidence of the complications, the denominator that they used was the number of anaesthetics over an entire year gathered from a two-week time period in September 2008. And then for the rest of that year, they asked individual hospitals to report any events. And just looking at the numbers that have actually come out of that report, there's almost 3 million general anaesthetics a year in the NHS. And there were only 184 reports that fitted the criteria for this project of either death, brain damage, or an emergency surgical airway. And I think that's quite reassuring to see that the incidence, if you do the maths of complications, is only 1 in 22,000. The risk of an emergency surgical airway being 1 in 50,000, and the risk of death or brain damage being 1 in 180,000. I think that was quite reassuring. When they actually analysed what led to these events, there's a few common themes that come out. Starting with just airway assessment, I think there's a tendency for people to have either done an incomplete airway assessment or they didn't alter the management of the airway even when they had done an assessment and recognised that it was likely to be tricky. Also, when there was an unexpected airway problem, there was very little plan for failure. So the responses to a can't intubate, can't ventilate scenario was unstructured, which is surprising considering how well published and well known the Difficult Airway Society guidelines for that situation are. A lot of times, from the case reports, it seems that a wake fibre optic was quite clearly indicated when what wasn't used, and there's no background given to that why they didn't choose the awake fibre optics and just carried on with a normal induction. And then again, as we often see in anaesthesia, there's mentions of task fixation and people trying repeatedly to carry on with an unsuccessful technique instead of changing their strategy and sort of making a bad situation quite a lot worse. And otherwise, I think, again, it highlights sort of certain types of patients. So it was obese patients, anyone with head and neck cancers, and obstetric patients. So there were some points that made me reconsider my own practice. I think one of them was when people are doing emergency cannula cricothyroidotomies, there's an incredibly high failure rate. About 60% of them didn't work. Whereas if you use a surgical technique for an emergency cricothyroidotomy, it's almost universally successful. And for me, I think it was important. I think I've now made my own decision. If I ever get into one of those can't intubate, can't ventilate scenarios, it's made it quite clear for me I'm going to go down the path of a scalpel and a bougie. Of the other things I've thought about, I think sometimes, especially as you get more senior in anaesthetics, you have a tendency to think you can sort of get away with an LMA. And one of the most common cause of death in the anaesthetic events was aspiration. And so I think, for me, certainly now, if doing a rapid sequence or intubating someone even vaguely crosses my mind, I'm definitely going to have a lower threshold for doing that. And of the overall, hypoxia was the most common cause of death. And I think that also just highlights again for us that you have to be really, really cautious in your pre-oxygenating and do a really good job. So, I think of the positive points of this, it was really good to see that all the hospitals and the NHS were really keen to participate. All 309 contributed, and very reassuring to see that the actual complications are rare. And really nice that they looked at when people called for senior help. In up to 50% of the cases, a second pair of hands arrived in less than 5 minutes. And majority of the time, in about 75%, that second pair of hands was a consultant. I think it's nice to see that there is a culture of an anaesthetics of helping your colleagues and coming at a time of emergency. I think so from that, where we go to from the NAP4 report is that I think everyone needs to make sure they have a for their airways, they have a proper strategy, not just an airway plan. So it's as trainees, we need to have a plan A, a plan B, and possibly a plan C as well. And again, it highlights the importance of the anaesthetic non-technical skills and simulator training. It's just always improving our ability for teamwork and communication and to try and prevent target fixation. So always being willing to try and, you know, step away and get a view of the whole picture. Can you wake the patient up? Is there a different piece of equipment or a different technique that you can try? So yeah, I think it's just a good memory to help us reflect on our own practice, and also to just remember to have a low threshold for asking for assistance from colleagues, because obviously having looked at this report, the technique that you're the most familiar with may not actually be the safest technique to manage the airway.
Well, thank you, Bex. That's an excellent summary of what was a huge, huge, complicated document. I've got to say, I've started going through the second section of it, going through the case summaries, just because they're really interesting. I think there's a lot you can learn. But just when you see the sheer volume of work that's gone into it, it's truly is amazing. One thing that stood out for me, and I think probably is in the recommendations, is the more widespread use of capnography everywhere else, including the ITU and including A&E, which is something, I mean, when I started doing anaesthetics, it was very rare we had capnography in A&E. And I've worked on a lot of ITUs that don't have it, but I've got to say, I think it does make a big difference, and certainly is something that makes me feel more secure, because as we're always taught, it's the one that instantly spots a problem. Whereas hypoxia, as again was what was shown in the NAT4, is the thing that causes the problems, and as we know, that's probably the last thing that people see.
Yeah, because that capnography, it's in line with the new ALS guidelines. They're insisting in it, and I think that's where you're going to find your difficult airways most common, isn't it? It's going to be A&E, it's anaesthesia, unfamiliar environment, or difficult patients, difficult airways, and you know, head collars and that sort of thing. So yeah, I think you're right. It does highlight that importance.
Yeah, but anyway, absolutely great, and I'm sure we'll be learning a lot more from that in the years to come. So, moving on, Frank, something that's probably not hugely in our minds generally, or not hugely taught at the moment, but is becoming more significant, is giving anaesthetics to infants and neonates and the potential effects it might have on them later in life. And I believe you've been looking at a recent paper for us.
Yeah, Rick, I have. And this really came about because I came across a pediatric nurse whilst on holiday. And we got into a discussion about the dangers of anaesthesia in small children. And I very happily told her with the foundationless confidence that you taught me to use at the FRCA final exam, that that was, of course, not true, and that it was entirely safe to anaesthetize small children. Sadly, unlike her, I'd not seen the editorial that had come out in the New England Journal of Medicine around about the time, and this was in April of this year, I think. And that really reported on a couple of things, but mostly on two studies published in 2009, one of them from the Journal of Neurosurgery and Anesthesiology. And that looked at hernia repairs in children under 3 years and the risk of anesthesia that then gave in terms of developing behavioral or developmental disorders later on. And as you can imagine, I mean, these are hard studies to perform. And this was a retrospective analysis of data held by Medicaid, so reasonably underprivileged children. But they looked at 380 kids in the first 3 years of life. And they were matched as well as they could to try and exclude, as you can imagine, the sorts of confounding factors, and children having hernia repairs are more likely to have other developmental problems or congenital disorders. So even taking into account these confounding factors, they used what's called a Cox proportional hazard model. And with that, with the benefit of that, these kids who had been exposed to anaesthesia had a hazard ratio of 2.3, just over two times more likely to develop developmental or behavioral disorders. And the other study was from anesthesiology in 2009, and that was of interest because it looked at groups of children and, again, whether they'd had one anesthetic or two anesthetics or more than two, and there was a cumulative risk with greater exposure or exposure to two or more anesthetics. And I think that's where this comes from. And the editorial in New England Journal really just gives us some food for thought. Obviously, we know from animal studies, and most of these studies have been done in monkeys, rhesus monkeys, and rats, and are easier to perform in rats because of the shorter life cycle. But we know from animal studies that NMDA antagonists, such as ketamine and anesthesia, as well as GABA agonists, such as isoflurane, are problematic in terms of problems with neurodevelopmental damage or damage to neuronal cells and in causation of cell apoptosis in these cells. And what we don't know is how that translates into humans. And these two studies really just give us some cautionary advice. And the debate now, I think, is becoming whether we should try and minimize the exposure to anesthesia in small children, certainly under 3 years of age, and whether this is going to herald an increase in the use of regional anesthesia where possible in children.
It's certainly a very interesting area of research. I think one of the cautions that we've all got to take on board is extrapolating animal work through to work in children. And as you've already said, it's very difficult to do these kind of studies. You've got to look at things long term, and the sort of neurodevelopmental changes we're picking up we're looking at are very, very, very subtle things, like people doing, you know, how well people are doing at school. And I know we are also looking at sort of cognitive behavioural disorders and the prevalence of those. But it's difficult research to do, and how well you can compare that to rats going around mazes or whatever, I don't even know what it is they do to assess monkeys. And I think another point to make is the type of anesthetics they're getting. One of the papers that it cites in the journal is some work done on a rhesus monkey, as you said. Sorry, a rhesus, not a rhesus monkey. That would be something quite different. But they were giving 12-hour ketamine anesthetics to 5-day-old rhesus monkeys. And that's obviously, you know, that you kind of intuitively feel that is going to do them some significant harm, although this was repeated with isoflurane, and yes, they did seem to have some neurodevelopmental problems then. So whilst we can't be too alarmist, I don't think anybody's suggesting we should deny this age group anesthetics for operations which they need. I think we need to look at this research with caution, and as you said, more good quality work to be done.
Yeah, I think one of the criticisms of the study was that there was no long-term follow-up of these cases necessarily. And that is one of the arguments out of a different paper in Anesthesiology 2011, so this earlier this year. And they looked at academic performance in adolescents. So it followed kids who'd had early exposure to anesthetic on into later life. And in fact, there, once co-founders had been adjusted for, found no statistical difference in their performance. So I think the jury is certainly still out.
I think academic performance is very subtle, because that's very subjective, and it depends how you're rating the academic performance as well. I mean, there's lots of different ways you could do that. Are they doing it by subject? Are they doing it by grades at a certain age? Are they doing it by a national standardized test? But anyway, definitely a very interesting area. So for my news item this month, and continuing my fascination with soundbites from the college, they recently tweeted, "Are trainees unprepared, to start obstetric on calls?" Which certainly struck a chord with me, because I always feel slightly unprepared to start obstetric on calls. Don't know why, I've never really got on with it, and I think it's probably because I'm quite frightened of loud noises. But this was an interesting survey. I know we've already covered one very large survey, but this was a joint OAA and Royal College survey, where they sent out papers to all of the lead obstetric anaesthetists at the various hospitals in the UK, then asked them about how their training worked, who was on their on-call rota, etc., etc. And this was built on a paper by Sham Janji, which was another survey that was in the April Bulletin, where he'd asked a lot of trainee anaesthetists how they felt about obstetric on-calls, and over a quarter, which is very significant, felt that they were unready to start them. And we'll put a link to that on the podcast notes. So just briefly, what caught my eye just looking at the numbers, the first and probably slightly worrying thing was that out of the 211 lead obstetric anaesthetists approached, they only had a 55.9% response rate, which seems poor, and they did say they were disappointed. You know, this isn't like, it's not one of those Survey Monkey type surveys that come through on your email about, you know, whether or not you're giving people warm fluids, which I know, Mark, you always
Delete.
answer as honestly as you yeah, people trying to do it. I mean, this is something coming from the OAA, so really you would think as a lead obstetric anaesthetist you'd be interested in it. The other thing that interested me was the initial assessment of competence that they now have to do, because when I did my obstetrics for the first time, I certainly didn't have to do that. I actually got a very good obstetric block and then was sort of given the nod by the lead obstetric anaesthetist, and then did some daytime on calls for a couple of weeks before then moving on to nights. That's certainly from this survey, from the published results in this survey, that does, you know, that's not an unusual story. And I think that is the case, and that certainly probably was the case when we were doing it. The point I was going to make is I think this initial assessment of competency for obstetrics is a good thing. It's not like the usual. I think obstetrics is very different from the normal SHO on-call fodder that you would get of, you know, appendices, bum abscesses, and diabetic feet. This is young people who are fit and healthy or having children and starting their families. It's very significant, and I'm pleased to see that there's now some kind of level of competence that needs to be formally assessed, gone through, and then logged with the college. I think that's great. What was less great was that only 74% of people were actually getting this completed before starting their on-call, which again I think is something that needs to be addressed, and I'm sure the OAA feel the same way. The other thing that surprised me slightly was that 48% of rotas have core trainees actually as part of the on-call rota. There weren't enough questions in there to really get specifics about if it was a core trainee on call, was there a senior anaesthetist in the hospital, or was it still somebody like a consultant potentially off-site? But just from my own personal experience, that seems quite a high figure. Again, maybe I was just led a very sheltered life and was doing on calls, was, you know, stuck doing the appendices and the hips when I was an SHO. But that seemed like quite a lot. And I think probably the two messages that came out of it were there was obviously considerable variation between hospitals, with some people having really, really good programs for their anaesthetic trainees doing their obstetric module, whereas some didn't seem to be so good. And I think a point which they didn't make, but actually I picked up from NAT4, was when you're looking at the reporting of these things, you have to assume that the person doing the reporting is someone who is enthusiastic and involved in the project, and therefore you will get is more likely to report things. So when they were doing the confidence intervals, looking at the NAT4 complications, they made the assumption that if the reporter was somebody who was reporting an incident that they were involved in, that was kind of the higher end of it, and they're assuming the cases missed were from, you have to assume you're going to miss so many cases, are going to come from people who are going to be less enthusiastic. So you're going to have your reporter up at the top end of your confidence interval, and the other people you sort of made this calculation on, which is very rough and ready, but at the bottom end, if that makes sense. But I think because you only got 55% return rate with this, it makes you wonder what the obstetric training is like for the obstetric anaesthetists who didn't, sorry, at the hospitals where the obstetric anaesthetist didn't return the form. It's a little bit worrying. The other thing that came up was the e-learning module, which I wasn't aware of. I don't know why I'd missed that. It was probably just me not having my finger on the pulse. But I thought that was great because, you know, everyone likes e-learning, especially me. But I was a bit sad in that I immediately signed up for it when I read the article, and thought, this is great. You can always do some more, you know, obstetric learning. It's kind of like eating your broccoli. But it took them just under a week to get a password back to me so I could actually go on and do the module, which I have to say, you know, epic fail by me. I then didn't do, but I kind of lost interest. I didn't really understand why it took so long for register me and everything. So a good survey, well conducted. Slightly poor response rate and some slightly worrying results for what's really is one of the core things that we spend a lot of our time on call doing.
You say a good survey, I still don't believe it. It's a 50% response rate and the conclusions are the blindingly obvious, that nobody feels ready to be on call, and people should have as much training as possible. Brilliant.
So what, you're making the point?
The recommendations in this survey are that training opportunities need to be maximised. Well, you don't need a survey to say that. And that people should do their competences before they go on call. Well, that's fine. And that nobody who feels unprepared to start obstetric on call should be expected to join the on-call rota. Again, we're not learning anything new here. They're all blindingly obvious points.
I mean, Mark, you're quite right. Those are fairly obvious conclusions to make. I mean, I think the survey was useful in the way it got a snapshot of the different levels of people who are doing the on-calls and the different amounts of training they get.
Yeah, I tend to agree with Rick. And I think the worry there is that we're getting a positively skewed picture of what training's actually like.
Exactly.
Well, the point I was making is it's likely to be the best 56%.
No, I think it's overall it's probably considerably worse. No, I was just saying I agree with your point, Rick, that I think those who haven't responded are probably less involved in oversight and training of their juniors.
Thanks, Frank. Which brings us to the end of our news segment and onto our new feature section, where we're hoping to do interviews and audio features on topics of anaesthetic interest.
So for this month's feature, I'm joined by Ala Belhaj, who's a Libyan doctor who's been working in the UK since 2001 and started doing anaesthetics here in 2005. Ala has recently returned from Tunisia, where he's been working for Libyan Doctors Relief. Since the beginning of the uprisings in February, Libya has been a continual focus for the current Arab Spring movement, with between a quarter and half a million refugees displaced so far. Ala, thanks very much for agreeing to talk to me today.
Thank you.
So if you could start by telling us whereabouts in Tunisia you were.
Well, we were based in a town called Tataouine, which is in the south of Tunisia. And that town has a small hospital with pretty basic facilities, but it's situated about 150 miles from the border, and that point is quite an important border because it's open to the rebels, and it's the closest town pretty much to the Libyan towns held by the rebels. So that town, Tataouine, was our base, if you like.
So it's pretty much acts as a funnel for fighters who have been injured, as well as refugees with medical conditions they may be having. They all pretty much converge onto Tataouine, and that's where the real focal point is for the humanitarian effort.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that was particularly true at the beginning, when all the casualties, pretty much, and the medical cases as well, used to go to the hospital straight away. However, with time, I think over the last 3 or 4 weeks, things have moved on. So there's sort of a field hospital just at the border, which does damage limitation surgery to trauma cases. There's two refugee camps which have makeshift clinics in them, so they see some patients as well. So it has taken some of the load off the hospital.
What sort of work were you doing on a sort of day-to-day basis while you were out there?
I mean, at the beginning, when I went out because they needed an anaesthetist, and there was a rota and there was a gap. So I joined them, but I found that actually I was out there for 7 days, but I found that actually I made more use of my time working as a general medical person, and sort of worked a couple of days at the camps. And set up a clinic on Monday in one of the small towns. And we used to go out in threes, so I did sort of a general medical clinic, and there was a paediatrician with us and an obs and gynae doctor, and we used to just see loads of patients. There was always plenty because they knew we were coming in advance, so they'd just congregate. Obviously, medicine was an issue, so we just took our medicines from the base hospital in Tataouine.
Okay, so coming back to that, so on those days you were pretty much doing sort of general GP type medical stuff,
yeah.
Not seeing casualties so much, but just seeing seeing to the medical needs of the displaced population.
That's right, yeah.
And the medicines you were bringing, because obviously they won't have a big stockpile of stuff in the refugee camp, they were from, you were saying, the hospital that was a little way away.
Yeah, we had our base, funny enough, in a hotel, which was in Tataouine, and there was an office and there was a big pharmacy, which people have sort of collected money over time, and we had pretty much every drug you could have outside a fridge in that pharmacy. So in the morning or the night before, I just get a big box, get all my drugs in that would cure most common ailments, and then we'd set off in the morning and I'd have most drugs. I made the mistake on the first day of not taking any drugs, and I think because there was another aid organisation there, I was allowed to use some of their drugs because they were giving them out for free. And that was, I think, because I didn't know the ropes. But it's sort of this Libyan doctor relief group have started out very small, but it's a bit more organised. And they are getting donations in, and they do have quite a good pharmacy. And I think it helps the patient not to give them a prescription, but at the end of seeing them, you just give them the medicines there, okay. And you know that they've got them. And there's always, like, once a day, you'd find somebody who you can't treat there or who needs an investigation. And I think over time, we've done, there's a mechanism for that as well. So they'd get referred. We can pay for them to go and have tests or have advanced investigations or something if they really needed it. That's more relevant for children, though. Yeah.
Okay. What about the anaesthetics you were doing over there? Whereabouts were you doing that? Was that back at the base, which, as you said, was a hotel room? So
yeah.
Presumably you weren't doing any of the work there.
It was mainly at the hospital. So the hospital had four theatres, and they're not used to seeing anaesthetic doctors at all. They run on technicians, which are doing a great job. The anaesthetics was at the hospital, and I used to sort of... my priority was to look after the trauma cases. So we used to get a lot of trauma cases. Had a few children, but they were mostly adults. They were rebels who'd been shot. And there's some horrendous injuries there. And I think because they lack a lot of the medicines, usually the anaesthetic usually involved obviously general anaesthesia, intraoperative and post-op resuscitation, and sometimes blocks as well for severely injured limbs. They, you know, dressings as well. I put in a few blocks for dressings change, and that's pretty much unheard of. And I think what they also found useful was finding an anaesthetist there, so there was always one of us around, and they used to giving rapid sequence inductions to all their women who were giving birth as well, and it was quite traumatic for all of us there, because within 3 days they had two maternal deaths and a stillborn because of lack of CTG. So we were very keen to be called at any time to do spinal anaesthesia and do neonatal resuscitation, whatever. So I think while we were there, on the days we were at the hospital, and there was always one of us around, I think there was a need for us. And when I came back, I ensured that there was continuity, and there were people who did go when we came back.
But it sounds like when on the days you're at the hospital, you're covering an intensive care unit, you're covering trauma theatres, you're covering general theatres to sort of some degree, and you're covering maternity.
Yeah, that makes it sound like a big hospital. But
and is this a field hospital, or is this a Tunisian proper hospital?
This is a Tunisian hospital.
Okay.
It's a district general, small district general. But covers a vast area. The population there is not very big, being sort of a desert type area, but it had, they say, trebled. Because I think just in that district of Tunisia, there's somewhere between 65 and 66,000 people who have moved into that area.
Now, from Libya?
From Libya. Now, only there's about 1,000 people in each camp, and there's two camps. So you can imagine all the other people being... Very few of them could afford a hotel. The others were just being hosted by generous Tunisian families who, some of them were quite hard up. So you'd have five or six people living in a very small house.
They've only just had quite a radical regime change themselves.
Exactly.
And in fact, one thing I keep reading is the incredible hospitality of the people in Tunisia, who seem to have been really excellent. Yeah.
It was really amazing to see. In the afternoons, we mostly sort of busied ourselves of handing out small envelopes of not very much money and, you know, clothes and things like that to these people who were living, sort of often a lot of families living in a small house. And we saw quite a lot of this, and impoverished families who were actually going out of their way to help people in need. And it was really touching to see that. So, I mean, the Tunisian people have been absolutely fantastic. I've never seen anything like it. That was what we did in the afternoons, and during the day it was sort of clinics or the hospital. But this is still a big problem.
What are the conditions like in the camps?
Camps were, I think there was a variety. There was one camp that nobody ever talks about, I think rightly, because it happens, it's in Tatooine, and it's provided by Qatar, and it's so well catered that actually people outside the camps are jealous, and some of them want to move in. But there's two other camps, one just at the border, it's called Tabor, and that is the border, and that camp is reasonable, large tents, good food, good sanitation, provided by Emirates, and but there's lots of input from other aid agencies. One that's not so good is called Ramada, and that's sort of halfway between the border and Tatooine on the main road. The conditions there are very poor, sort of plastic, I think they are plastic, the tents. They are very, very hot, obviously being in the middle of the desert, very small, you can't stand in them, the food is less than basic, and sanitation is very poor. It's mostly, I think it's a joint effort between the UN and the UN Refugee Agency, and there's obviously input from the Tunisian government as well, but I think it's sort of the least suitable conditions, really, of all the camps.
So you're part of one group of doctors, but there's others who are obviously out there, like Doctors Without Borders, yeah, and the UNHCR. So are you forming rotas in conjunction with them, or are you all kind of going to the camps in the morning and doing your own thing?
The MSF are doing a huge relief effort, but at best it's still sporadic. So what you notice there and what you hear from people is that like small towns will be hit a couple of times by an MSF convoy who will see them, but there's lots of other areas maybe they don't go to. The boxes and the relief material doesn't necessarily get to everywhere. And I think MSF, and also foreign relief agencies sometimes have the limitation of maybe there's a language barrier as well. So on some of the MSF convoys, they have purely Tunisian doctors, and those were the more useful because they all obviously speak Arabic. There aren't that many relief agencies, to be honest, and I think there is a lot of reliance on the Tunisian people, generosity.
I think one of the things that's very different about, from what I've been talking to you, as opposed to other people who have gone overseas and have done relief work, is that obviously you're from Libya and these are your country, this is your country and this is your kin that you're treating. And as you touched upon, being able to speak Arabic is obviously an advantage, but it must make it very different from other people who are going along as part of these agencies, much more personal, and it must make some of the sort of decision making you have to do when you're treating patients a little more difficult.
Yeah, I think that there is some truth in that. What you find is that when you go outside the camps and treat within towns, you're actually seeing 50% of the time you're seeing Tunisian patients as well. And it's astounding the lack of medical care that people have had to put up with for decades. Really? The chief of one of the towns had bilateral club feet when he was welcoming us. This guy had never seen a doctor and didn't realise it was reversible at a very young age. There's all sorts of problems that you see. These towns are very, their population is very low because their infant mortality rate has never been recorded. So we see 50% of the time we see Tunisian patients, and there's obviously a continuing need. And I think when Libya's recovered from this, what the TNC, or the Transitional Council, that's hopefully going to run Libya in the interim, is promising is that whatever medical equipment or whatever medical material goes to Tunisia now will stay there and will continue to support this area that's been so good to us. In terms of how I feel being a Libyan, it's obviously much more personal, but yes, I mean it's being a country that I'm from and not being able to cross the border because it's a war zone and actually be there to pick up the casualties at the site is obviously very difficult. Yes.
So thanks very much, Alla. That's really interesting and is given us really valuable insights to not only what it's like to work in a refugee camp, but also the current situation that's going on there. So thanks very much for talking to us.
Thank you, and I wish you all the best with your podcast.
Thank you.
Finally, it's time to play Biology or Bunkum, the segment where I'm going to present my three co-hosts with four news items from this month's General Science and Health Biology Journalism, and they're going to tell me which one is the fictional story that I've invented. So are you guys ready? So number one, the CDC, which is the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in the US, this month issued a zombie apocalypse warning, where they put up on their website a way for the good US citizens to protect themselves against an imminent zombie attack. Number two, ketamine, which is now being used to treat depression in some experimental models, has also been found to be a surprise cure for impotence. Number three, preparation is being made to perform the world's first womb transplant, where the donor is in fact the recipient's mother. Number four, new research has shown that the key to successful dieting may be to imagine your food to be of higher calorific value than it in fact is. So, which one of those is in fact the bunkum, and which three are in fact true stories from this month's Science Press? Mark, do you want to have a crack at it first?
Yeah, so a womb transplant, you say. So that a mother donates a womb to her own daughter.
Yes, that is entirely correct.
So that the daughter can then nurture a fetus of her own in the same womb that she used to be in.
Who
I think
needs
that's
therapy in later life.
Yeah, there's how on earth would that get past an ethics committee? Does that make them like sisters, or it's like some weird intra-abdominal incest going on there? I don't like it.
It doesn't matter if you don't like it. Is it science?
Yeah. Why would it have to be their mother? I'd smell a rat. I think your zombies suggestion's too obvious for you. I'm going to stick with the womb transplant being
okay.
Bunkum.
Bex, do you want to go next? Give us your views on these news stories.
I'm definitely going to go for the fact that the zombies was total nonsense, mainly because I caught the end of a news presentation the other day, and it was saying that someone had written in about a zombie attack and if there was a management plan in place. But I don't think that the CDC would have then published a plan, although I do believe that someone had written in. Otherwise, I've read recently about this, imagine the food, and it's about also, there's in the same article, there was something about imagining your food of higher calories, and not in a study that was published that if you close your eyes when you eat food, or eat food with your left hand, or make sure you don't have any distractions, you'll eat less. So I think that's definitely true. So yeah.
You're going with
I'm
the zombies.
Stick with the zombie story.
The zombies are fictitious and not coming to get us. Okay, Frank, up to you.
Yeah, likewise, I don't think we're in imminent danger of an attack from the undead. So I'm going to go with that one as being bunkum.
Ah, the zombie apocalypse.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, then. In no particular order, then, seeing as Bex pretty much blew my research out of the water on the dieting, there has, in fact, been a study done at Yale University where they've got 46 healthy volunteers to enjoy a 380-calorie milkshake, but they've told half of them that it's a very high-calorie, high-fat milkshake, and they told the other half that it is, in fact, one of those slim-fast type things. And then taken their levels of a hormone called ghrelin that I've never come across, which does seem a bit suspect to me, but this is in the journal Health Psychology.
Yeah, that does exist. I've actually come across that.
You have come across it? Ghrelin. Okay, well, apparently it spikes half an hour before mealtimes and then returns to normal after eating. And they found that those who believed they'd indulged significantly, so had the higher calorie milkshake, showed much greater drops in the level of ghrelin. So, I mean, it's not a huge stretch to imagine that, you know, your brain can obviously affect your neuroendocrine function. But the way they're extrapolating that piece of research is saying if you imagine you're eating high-calorie foods, then you'll have better satiety and you won't be so hungry, which is obviously the main problem with dieting. So that is, in fact, science. Mark, you were particularly disgusted by the womb transplant, so maybe I should go on to explain that is, in fact, science. In Sweden, apparently, they are making preparations to do the world's first womb transplant, which, as you quite rightly pointed out, is going to be implanting the womb from which a girl was born back into her so that she can then have another child with it, which I've got to say made me balk slightly when I heard it. But the reason for that is, firstly, because this girl who lives in Stockholm has something called Meyer-Rokitansky-Kusterhauser syndrome, which I've certainly never heard of, but means that she's actually euteric. But she seems to have her own ova. So the eggs will be her own, but she just needs an incubator, essentially. What I didn't know, which is interesting, is that this was an article from the New Scientist, and they did ask the question, wouldn't it be much easier just to have a surrogate? But apparently, in Sweden, surrogacy is illegal. So this does seem like a reason. Yeah, surrogacy.
Really?
The question was, if a woman has no womb at all, or one that's damaged, wouldn't it be simpler just to fertilise her eggs and implant them in the womb of a surrogate mother, or in fact her own mother, which I think has happened? And the scientist in question said that would be a reasonable alternative, but in Sweden, surrogacy is illegal. But apparently the slightly Frankenstein-like procedure is in fact perfectly okay.
What happens if this woman's daughter also has the same syndrome? Will this uterus get handed down from generation to generation?
you've got to wonder how many babies are still has in it. Because I did read this article, and I believe the woman who's donating the uterus, so this other woman's mother, has three children. Is that right, Rick?
I don't know. It's not mentioned here.
But she has had other children. Firstly, and the other note of caution I would say is that unbelievably, or just not that I hadn't heard of this before, but this procedure has actually been performed previously. However, the womb had to be removed, I think, after a few months. I can't recall the exact time period, but and all it said in the article I read was that it had to be removed due to complications.
As long as it lasts 9 months, that's all you need, really, isn't it?
Yeah, Frank, were you saying about how it had happened before in Saudi Arabia?
I didn't know where it was, but in the article I read, it said that they have performed the transplant previously,
yeah.
But it was unsuccessful or had complications a few weeks afterwards.
Yeah, no,
that is actually really gross. It all got clotted off and nasty,
but it was someone who'd had it removed. Yeah.
Can I just say that is absolutely disgusting? No, just as a side, it's a revolting.
But would
idea.
You accept a uterus transplant from your mother? Maybe that's how you can do.
What's grim. That? Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Anyway, moving on. So, next, it's the zombie apocalypse. This is in fact a true story. If you go to the CDC website and look up their on their blogs from May, you'll see that they advertise Preparedness 101, the zombie apocalypse, with the tagline, get a kit, make a plan, be prepared. It's got such useful information on it as to identify the types of emergencies that are possible in your area. Besides a zombie apocalypse, this may include floods, tornadoes or earthquakes. If you're unsure, contact your local Red Cross chapter for more information. Basically, it's trying to get people to be ready. There are portions of America that are very prone to natural disasters, and making sure that people are ready with the right sort of water, food, medications, supplies, they know where they're going. As they say, get a kit, make a plan, be prepared. But the best way for them to do this was in the setting of a zombie apocalypse. But of course, all of this information is completely transferable to pretty much any other thing. They've made no mention of make sure you have a large supply of baseball bats and shotguns and aim for the brain. Well, precisely.
States have
precisely.
That already, don't
it's
they?
Got, you know, it's really well done. Plan your evacuation route.
How much does a zombie kit cost?
They don't sell them. They tell you how to sort of amass your own. It's public. The CDC are all about public information. I think they were just looking at another way of getting their message across. But it's quite good. It's quite well done. It doesn't make it. It's not sort of too subtle. It's, you know, plan your evacuation route. When zombies are hungry, they won't stop until they get food, i.e., brains, which means you need to get out of town fast. Plan where to go and multiple routes, which would take you ahead of time so the flesh eaters don't have a chance. This is also helpful when natural disasters strike and you have to take shelter fast. So,
just to clarify for Bex, those zombies don't exist, Rebecca. It's not something you're
it's not so, yeah, so You don't need to be frightened, but do prepare for other apocalyptic events. Nice to see we all survived the rapture, by the way. Nobody got taken away.
I'm glad we're all here.
Yeah, glad we're all still here. So that leaves us with the ketamine story, which was in fact the bunkum. Ketamine is in fact being
very good.
Yeah, well there you go. Trick you every time. Ketamine is in fact being used as an sort of experimental treatment for depression at the moment, and we're going through very much sort of NMDA antagonist renaissance, and it's getting more use in anesthesia, but other finding uses in other fields such as chronic pain and depression. However, there was an article in the British Journal of Urology this month, which was showing that people who use ketamine quite a lot, apparently several times a week over several years, but suffer from bladder problems. So it's not actually a cure for impotence. These people are now presenting with incontinence and bladder pain, which might have a word that I can't now remember. Might have implications.
Implications.
Yeah, these are recreational
users you're talking about.
For the people who are now thinking ketamine is actually a really useful drug, we can use it for this, that, and the other. Not if it's going to make you incontinent. And this seems to be a big problem. There's studies being done in the lab now looking at bladder cytology with ketamine, and it seems to cause some problems with the actual lining of the bladder itself. So that was the bunkum. Don't take ketamine for impotence. There is no benefit in being in the K-hole. Which brings us neatly to the end of this month's podcast. I hope you enjoyed it and will join us next time. Thank you for listening.